Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, January 8th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We'll go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me as we fire up a hump day edition of the show here. Two guests join me on the program. The first, Greg Peterson at GUnit_81 on Twitter. You know him from the Hoopin' with Hoops podcast and also contributor to VSiN. We're going to talk some college basketball and some NFL playoffs here to open up today's show. Then in the second half of today's program, Wes Reynolds, you can also hear on VSiN at Wes Reynolds and the number one will join me. We'll talk NFL playoffs with him, then also take a look at the Sony Open out in Hawaii. Over at bangthebook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Speaking of the Sony Open, we got a preview of that from James Mazzola for you to check out. You definitely want to make sure you do that. Daily NHL from Parker Michaels, daily NBA and college basketball from myself, Admir Algic, Alan Moody. We've got UFC rolling around again next week. We'll be covering that. NASCAR comes back in February. We'll cover that. Major League Baseball not that far away. And, of course, plenty of stuff for the College Football National Championship game as well as the rest of the NFL playoffs. So plenty of stuff going on over at bangthebook.com. Make sure you check it all out. Finally, as you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio, presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. BTB and the number 200 is that promo code. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook. 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. Couple of guests joining me on the program here today. The first is Greg Peterson from the Hoopin' with Hoops podcast and also contributor to VSiN and their Point Spread weekly newsletter. Greg, how's it going today, man?
I'm doing great. The fact that I get to be, I guess you could call it the warm-up for Wes Reynolds, makes me feel very good as well. Guy does terrific work, and great to be on with you. I know that I've had you on my podcast, so it's a pleasure, my man. Thank you.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for joining me and taking time out of that insanely busy schedule that you've got to chat a little bit of college basketball and some NFL here with me today. And, you know, look, we're through the holidays, we're through the exam weeks, we're through winter breaks, which means that you got a lot of teams here playing true road games in hostile environments, and the students are actually back on campus now. So I want to talk a little bit about home court advantage and what it's worth to you, how you factor in, how do you come up with the values that you're going to put on home court?
Every school to me is a little bit different because there are so many people that they're just like, oh, we're going to award a generic 3 points. And to me, that's a really lazy way of going about it. I have a girlfriend that used to attend Florida International University. Florida International University does not get 3 points because whenever I take a look at their home games, there is absolutely nobody in the stands whatsoever. Getting to Florida International is a little bit different also than getting to a place like Grand Forks, North Dakota. I actually wrote up something like this for VSiN's Point Spread Weekly, which is out today. The Summit League has been very hot to home favorites going into Wednesday. Home favorites in the conference, 24-8 against the spread. Meanwhile, you take a look at the ACC. We saw on Saturday, two home teams won outright. We even saw it in the SEC yesterday. Three of the four home teams, they lose outright. So it's one of these things where home court is very different place to place. When you look at the up at the rafters at Rupp Arena, it's a little bit different than looking up at the rafters at, say, Merrimack College, who's in their first year at the Division I level. It's one of those things that you have to take on a case-by-case basis. And I actually learned this from Benny Maliulo. Many of you guys may know him from the Vegas Asset Information Network. Does a terrific job. He has been in this industry for so long that it's not even funny. But he is a guy that I talked to about this very same topic. And something that he outlined to me is just getting to the place as well. Like I was talking about Grand Forks, North Dakota, a little bit more difficult to get there than it is to a major city like a Portland, Oregon, or something like that. And that's all something I take into my handicapping as well. These teams are different on the road. There are some teams that they relish the opportunity of being able to play a true road game. Meanwhile, there's a team like Iowa that's been hitting at about a 31-32% clip in true road games the past 4 years.
Yeah, there are a lot of excellent points. So we'll kind of break them down a little bit more as we go along here. But I love the point that you talked about getting to some of these places. I mean, you know, if you're in the Big Ten, it's not hard to fly into Columbus. It's not hard to fly into, you know, Madison or something like that. But if you were in one of these smaller conferences, like a Big Sky or something like that, yeah, you may be able to get to some small regional airport or, you know, maybe take a charter flight that can land somewhere close. You also may have to land in a big city and take a 3-hour bus ride to get wherever you're going. So that definitely factors into the equation. And I don't think people think about that a whole lot. They see, you know, the atmosphere in the IZ zone at East Lansing, or they see, you know, what we used to see in places like Indiana or what you see at Duke with the Cameron Crazies. Those players are used to that. It's a little bit different when you go and play in a 2,000-seat arena in the middle of nowhere, and it was hard for you to get there. The smaller conferences, home court advantage is magnified so much more, I think.
I do agree with you. You can never count out just the screaming fans in general, because there are some teams that their kryptonite is at the free throw line. And when you got everyone screaming, you got everyone on top of you, that is something that you have to take a look at as well. And you can't just look at the crowd capacity too, because we all revere the Kennel over at Gonzaga as being one of the better home courts in all of college basketball. It's not because they've got a million billion seats like the Carrier Dome. It's because those fans, they are right there with you, sort of like a Cameron Indoor, because you always see Cameron Indoor, all the fans reaching out, they're like inches away from the inbounder and everything like that. That's something that you got to take a look at as well. It's just these little intricacies that sometimes can make the biggest of difference. That's why I don't award a generic 3 points for home court. There are some home courts that they only get like half of that. It's almost as if some of these home courts are actually a neutral court, because even with a team like Duquesne, one of the things that I really look at with Duquesne is the fact that they don't have a true home court advantage. Their new arena is either under renovation or it's being built, something of that nature. But I recall their last home game was on the campus of Robert Morris. It's harder for the kids to get there. And the people that do actually get there, are they actually going to be those rowdy fans that are screaming it up when they're shooting free throws? Probably not. So it's just taking these little things into account and adjusting. Okay, Cameron Indoor, it's a little bit different than playing at Duquesne, wherever the heck they're playing. Duke, maybe you award more than 3 points. Duquesne, you award a little bit less than that. And you take a look at the team that they're playing as well and how they travel.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you is, you know, how dynamic is home court advantage for you? I mean, do you have, you know, your baseline number for each individual team and then leave it at that? Or, you know, is it something where you kind of adjust it based on, you know, maybe the visiting team is very young at the guard position to where the crowd noise may bother them a little bit more? Do you get that detailed with it, or do you just kind of have your number for that setting for that team and just use that when putting together your spreads?
It's very dynamic, because obviously we always hear about the 3 points for home court, and that's sort of a jumping off point. But then from there, you do a little bit of extra research. You take a look at some of these home and road splits. Like, a player that comes to mind for me is John Petty of Alabama. When he was a freshman 2 years ago, this guy was terrible away from Tuscaloosa. You get him at home, he was lights out. He was giving you a little bit of everything. He was knocking down threes. He was grabbing rebounds. The second that he left the city of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, the man forgot how to play basketball. This year, away from Alabama, he's shooting over 50% from three. He's actually putting up better numbers than he does at home. That actually gives Alabama a little bit of an edge. And you get some of these teams that they're very good in true road games, like Belmont last year. Straight up, I think that they won 14 games on the road. You've got to be gauging them a little bit differently than the team that I mentioned a little bit earlier in Iowa. Going into this year, Iowa was only covering 32% of their true road games. They actually got off to a nice start this year, winning straight up against Syracuse and Iowa State, finding out that Syracuse is a little bit of a flaw. And go figure, right when Big Ten play begins, Iowa winds up losing on a road floor yesterday against Nebraska. A Nebraska team that, let's face it, not very good. So there are just some teams that travel a little bit differently than others as well. And you got to sort of put a red flag next to them as well.
Now, for those that don't know, if you follow Greg on Twitter at GUnit_81, you will find out quickly that he plays a side in total on every game. Do you feel like this is something that the market does not have a good grasp of? Do you think that the work you put into home court advantage is something that's a large part of your college basketball edge?
I would say so, because like I've been saying so much on this podcast, it feels like a lot of people, they gauge home court generically, and let's face it, these bookmakers, they're really looking at Duke versus North Carolina. They're looking at, okay, what should we set the number for in Ohio State versus insert your Big Ten team here game, because they're going to get a lot of handle. They're not really looking at the home court of Central Arkansas and sitting there thinking, is this a little bit more of a rowdy crowd than normal? Cal Baptist, a school that's been at the Division I level for literally 2 years, they've actually got a very good home court. I know a couple people actually out there in that part of the country, they've been very impressed, and they've relayed that to me. And it's one of those things where I feel like I've got a little bit of an edge there, because the bookmakers, they're willing to take a little bit more of a loss on that, say, Cal Bakersfield versus Cal State or Cal Baptist game, rather than Duke versus North Carolina, where they've got all the money pouring in. They're going to have their numbers pretty dialed in. They're probably going to shade those numbers up when a team hits a Deem Dome, when a team hits Cameron Indoor. They've got those numbers pretty dialed in. They're not necessarily focusing on the travel that it takes out there in the Summit League to get to, like, Macomb, Illinois, where Western Illinois plays.
All right, so I want to ask you about conference play here, because, I mean, that's really going to be the thing now throughout the conference tournaments. Once we get into March Madness, obviously, not nearly as many conference games, but you have a few one-off non-conference games, maybe some geographic rivalries. You know, ESPN used to show the Bracket Busters series, and you get some non-conference games out of that. But primarily right now, it's conference play. So I think a lot of people sort of look at college basketball as three seasons within a season. Non-conference, conference, and then postseason with the conference tournaments, March Madness, CBI, NIT, so on and so forth. So how is the handicap different for you now with conference play than it was earlier with non-conference?
We were just talking about home court advantage and everything like that, and it feels like it's a little bit more magnified this time of year, because when you were taking a look at some of these games in the middle of December, you've got kids on winter break, you've got some empty seats, everything like that. Now it seems like everyone is coming off their break, and there's just a little bit more juice in general. When you take a look at some of these games, you have to take into account just the rivalry factor in general. There are some of the best rivalries in all of college basketball. Obviously, you've got all the ones out there in the ACC between the Blue Blood schools. Kentucky has so many great rivalries with the schools that they play in the SEC, and you know that a team is going to be juiced up, because you take a look at just some of these schools that are struggling a little bit, like in Nebraska. It probably made their season, the fact that they were able to knock off Iowa yesterday. You knew that they were going to be coming out, and you knew that they were going to be coming in there just giving it their all. And something else that you want to look at as well, just schools that maybe have a little bit of sanctions on them. Georgia Tech, a very good example. Georgia Tech is going to be ineligible for the postseason this year. If Georgia Tech were eligible, not saying that they'd be a slam dunk for the NCAA tournament or anything like that, but they actually played some halfway decent basketball out there at the Diamond and Classic. Now, obviously, they took that terrible home loss against Syracuse in December. No fans or buts about it. That was big, but you got to be thinking that because they're unable to go to the postseason, every game that they play is going to be like a postseason game for them. We see them catching double digits tonight against Duke. That might be a huge motivation spot, because they're not going to be going to the NCAA tournament, but they have a chance to be able to ruin the season of Duke and possibly knock them down to maybe from the number one overall spot to maybe, say, the 3-4 spot when it's all said and done.
No, that's an excellent point. We talk about a game, you know, quote unquote, being a team Super Bowl. Well, for Georgia Tech, getting Duke at home, you know, in some of these big premier matchups, these are their tournament games, like you said, since they won't be eligible to go to the postseason. And something that's almost kind of a corollary point to that is, you know, if you're a major conference school, you know, one of the Big Five or the Big Six, whatever you want to call them in college basketball, you don't necessarily have to win your conference to get in. Conference tournament seeding doesn't matter as much. If you're in a low major and a one bid league, or you're a mid major and your chances of getting an at-large berth are very, very small, I think that kind of factors into the equation too. Utah State, kind of a team, it's an example for me. Utah State losing that game over the weekend to San Diego State, they will not get an at-large berth now. That was pretty much a must-win game for them to have any chance of doing it. Maybe a little bit of a hangover effect at Air Force last night with a horrendous second half. They get blown out by 19. For Utah State now, their focus is entirely on the Mountain West Conference tournament. So there's also those dynamics in play as we go throughout the conference portion of the year.
And a big thing with Utah State for me as well, which is the reason why I've been fading them the last couple of games, is the fact that they were playing out here in Las Vegas about a week or so ago. I had a buddy that was at one of the games, and he just told me straight up, Sam Merrill does not look right now. And he was able to give Utah State 10 points yesterday. It's not like he looked absolutely anemic when you just look at the raw box score, but when you look at some of these teams in person and you look at that game between Air Force and Utah State from yesterday, you could tell Sam Merrill was not at 100%. He was not running the way that he typically is. This offense is not as dynamic. It is not as free-flowing when Sam Merrill's not as, at 100% as well. Namus Keita has come back to the fold, obviously, had a very nice game against San Diego State in a loss. But by and large, that's one of the things that you have to look at as well, because when you just look at a raw box score and a guy doesn't show up on the injury report on Twitter, you have to think, oh, he's just fine, when sometimes it's not the reality at all, which is why I always recommend to people, try to watch as many games as possible. You don't need to watch the game start to finish, because you guys know me. I'm one of these people. I handicap so many games. There's no way that I'm able to watch every one of these games because, well, let's face it, I just don't have more than 24 hours in a day, unfortunately. If there's a way that that could be changed, I would certainly love that. But with that said, it's just catching some bits and pieces of games, being able to watch like 5 minutes of Utah State versus Air Force here, being able to watch a couple minutes of Ohio State versus Maryland, going game to game to game, and just being able to get a little bit of each team, get a nice taste, so that way you can see if there is a glaring injury like Sam Merrill's for Utah State, there you're able to pick up for it, and you're able to adjust accordingly.
No, that's an excellent point. Again, I mean, you know, those are things you really can't pick up in a box score. And also, too, with 353 teams, finding out injury information can be a real challenge in a lot of different ways. So that's part of the equation here, too, where, you know, like, for example, I wrote up a preview over at bangthebook.com today for East Tennessee State and UNC Greensboro. And you know, you've got both of those teams kind of dealing with a couple of injuries. Greensboro certainly dealing with more than East Tennessee State. It's hard to find that type of stuff, to find out if guys are actually going to play, how healthy they are. If you get a chance to get eyes on a game, always a good opportunity to do that. One more thing I wanted to ask you about here with regards to conference play is that, you know, the schedule gets very repetitive now. When you're in non-conference, you may play, you know, Monday, Friday, maybe Saturday. Some teams had some really long breaks with the exam weeks. A lot of times in conference play, you're playing on a set schedule. You're playing Thursday, Saturday. You're playing Saturday, Monday. You're playing Wednesday, Sunday. Something like that, depending on the league that you're in. Do you feel like the more rhythmic nature sort of helps teams, whether it's, you know, underdogs or favorites in conference play?
I think that it's a little bit interesting to take a look at this as well, because it feels like there are some teams that they do very well coming off of rest, and there are other teams that it's not so much. I think that what it bodes well for is teams that have depth. A team like a Florida State right now that's able to go 9 or 10 deep, a VCU. These teams, when you're sort of playing two games a week, you know when you're going to be playing, it's absolutely huge. Right now, with playing a couple more games per week than normal, it's really hurting a team like Syracuse. Syracuse wound up having to play with a 6-man rotation yesterday against Virginia. They just have absolutely nobody that they can go to off the bench. And when you're a little bit gassed, you'll really feel that on a game-to-game basis. And I believe that's the reason why Virginia Tech wound up coming back in that game against Syracuse yesterday, because Syracuse in the first half, not like they were blowing the doors off of Virginia Tech or anything like that, but they looked pretty solid. But as the game was going on, they were wearing down more and more and more. And Virginia Tech, they had a little bit more depth. They were able to hit those threes. So that's big as well. Just with regards to the schedule, the teams that have that set rotation, they know who they're going to be playing. They know that they're able to rely upon a couple guys coming off the bench. I think that that is huge, because if you've got a team that they're just not having a lot of options to come off the bench, if something goes wrong, what the heck do they do? Because they have no backup option.
Yeah, that's a great point, too. So what are you looking at in regards for that? I mean, are you looking at percentage of minutes played? Are you looking at bench scoring metrics? How do you sort of isolate the teams that have depth versus those that don't?
For one, obviously, just the amount of teams that you see, or the amount of players that you see, play at least 10 minutes. For me, the benchmark is always a double-digit amount of minutes. If a team has, like, only 6 guys giving the team 10 plus minutes, that's something that you look at and you say that's a little bit of a red flag. Meanwhile, if they're going 8 plus, That's a team with some very good depth. And also you're looking at the range of players as well, because there are certain players that do a little bit of different things. If you've got a team in which everyone is seemingly 6'6", shoots in the mid-30s from three-point range, yeah, you could have nine guys on the roster, but if they're all doing the exact same thing, you're not giving teams different looks, which is why I believe that Auburn is coming into tonight undefeated with Auburn. This is a bunch that they've got so many guys that do a variety of different things. You've got a Samir Dowdy that's able to shoot threes, Javon McCormick, very good facilitator. And then you've got Austin Wiley, who's a traditional low post player. And then coming off the bench, Anthony McLemore, maybe he doesn't do as good of a job on the glass as Austin Wiley, but what he does a better job of is being able to block shots, being able to just play good, solid defense in the paint in general. When you have a team that they're able to give you a variety of different looks and they're able to compensate when things aren't necessarily going right, that gives them a little bit of a boost with regards to my power rankings and on a game-to-game basis as well.
All right, so speaking of some games here, let's take a look at a trio of games for tonight and kind of get some thoughts into the mind of Greg Peterson and how he handicaps these games on a game-by-game level. We start, and we'll go by rotation order here. We'll go 8-15, 8-16 here. Kansas and Iowa State, number down from 6.5 to 4.5. Total coming down a little bit from 146 to as low as 145 out there in the market. We talk about home court. We talk about conference play. We talk about the Big 12. So what do you think about this line coming down here with Iowa State getting a little bit of the early love?
And I'm seeing some fives out there as well. So it seems like there might be a little bit buyback here as we do this with Kansas. But I absolutely love Iowa State in this spot. A big reason why, his name is Tyrese Haliburton. In my opinion, he is the most versatile point guard in all of college basketball. Many of you guys may know, I am a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, out there in Wisconsin. I've had a chance to see him up close and in person because Tyrese Haliburton, born and raised in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. So far this year for Iowa State, he's been averaging right around 2.7 to 2.8 turnovers per game, over 7.5 assists, shoots over 40% from three. He's able to get over a steal per game. He pulls in rebounds. This guy is a walking triple-double. And we've got, in my opinion, the most complete and versatile player out there on the floor. It gives a lot of value to an Iowa State team that we've seen year after year after year. It doesn't matter how their season's going. They always push Kansas at home. They call it Hilton Magic for a reason, and a reason why I would not be willing to lay the points here with Kansas as well. You've got a guy in Udoka Azubuike that is absolutely tremendous down low. He's able to give Kansas right around 8 rebounds. Shoots over 70% from the floor. Too bad he doesn't shoot 70% at the free throw line. We saw it a couple years ago when the team was taking on Oklahoma. He was just bricking threes left and right. If you keep him out there on the floor in, say, like a five-point game with a minute to go, massive liability. And then when you pull him off the floor, this Kansas team is not the same either. And what I do notice about Kansas is the fact that I believe that they have allowed each out of their last five opponents to fewer than 70 points as well. They've been doing a good job of D-ing up. Really, other than that overtime game against TCU as well, Iowa State has been solid. And I throw that Florida A&M game out of the fold because I was just mentioning how big Tyrese Haliburton is for Iowa State. The reason why he's so big is because we saw it on Florida's full display in that game against Florida A&M, because he was out of the game. They wind up losing it outright. Whenever he's been out there on the floor, this team has been very solid. I just don't see who gets a 70 in the spot with both these teams playing solid defense. And I do think that Iowa State, at the very least, is going to push Kansas. I don't know if they win the game outright, but I certainly love taking the points in this matchup.
All right, so we jump down to game 825, 826 here. That's Seton Hall and Xavier. Xavier, 2.5 or 3, pretty much across the market. Big move up on the total for this one, 134.5, all the way up to as high as 139.5. There are no easy games in the Big East. According to Bart Torvik, all these teams in the top 71. According to KenPom, these teams all in the top 73. So no nights off here in the Big East. What do you think about this one tonight between Seton Hall and Xavier?
And we saw this total tick up a lot in Xavier's last game against St. John's as well. And what I found very interesting is that I think that total actually middled as well. So if you got in on the under late, you were able to cash. If you got in on the over at the ground level overnight, you had a very good chance of being able to get to the window as well. I could see something similar here. I think that's going to be a little bit of a higher scoring game because I do think that this could be something like a five-point game with a minute to go. And then from there, you get that march to the free throw line. And we all know with Seton Hall, they're currently without Sandro Mamukelashvili. He's a 6'10" big man that was able to shoot threes for this team. And with Xavier, If they specialize in something, it's cleaning up the glass. Tyreek Jones is able to give the team 10 rebounds per game. Najee Marshall, very versatile player. He's been hauling in there right around 7.5 rebounds. They bring in a graduate transfer from Ohio and Jason Carter. He's able to give you some rebounds. And with Seton Hall, with Mahmoud Kalashvili not in there, you're really relying upon Romero. Gil down low, he's able to give you some size at 7 feet tall, but he's not necessarily a guy that's going to give you 10-plus rebounds on a given night. Now, you're going to have the best guard out there on the floor for Seton Hall, Miles Powell. We all know what he's able to do. Over 21 points, shoots it well from three, in two games back from injury in the Big East. He's been able to do well. And Seton Hall, to their credit, they've already got a true road win against DePaul in conference. But I do think that Xavier, a team that seemingly plays a two-possession game in every single game that they play, which is why they just have not been covering. They've been laying a couple too many points. Actually might be in a little bit of a good spot here to cover just because the numbers seem to be down a little bit from the beginning of the year, and I feel like there might be a little bit of overcorrection because I think that Xavier should win this game by multiple possessions, not just one.
All right, one more game I want to talk about here tonight, and that is Arkansas and LSU, game 841-842. LSU up from 5 to 6, a few 6.5 starting to pop now as well. Total also going up on this game, 144 to as high as 147. And something I think is really interesting, it's something worth talking about here without going into deep detail. People remember LSU going to the Sweet 16 last year. They were a 3 seed. They were a top 20 team in the eyes of a lot of people. They are down a little bit this year, and this can be very dangerous for people that are just now getting into college basketball because college football is virtually over. The NFL playoffs, really the only thing in town for a lot of people. They may fall victim to what they saw last year, not realizing that LSU is just not as good as they were last season, and Arkansas is actually quite a bit better than they were last season.
And what I like about Arkansas is how well they guard the arc. This is a team that, among all teams in college basketball, number one with regards to three-point shooting percentage defense. But here's what I will say. LSU is not a team that relies upon the three-point shot. As a collective, they are 307th in the country with regards to three-point shooting percentage, and yet they're in the top 10 of offensive efficiency. The reason why? They go down low with guys like Emmett Williams, Darius Days. They do a good job of being able to grab rebounds. And this is an Arkansas team that they play positionless basketball. Eric Musselman has come over from Nevada, and he's implemented the same style that he did with the Wolfpack last year. You don't have a sure big man, but you've got a bunch of guys that are 6'6", 6'7". They're Swiss Army knives. They do a little bit of everything. And what I find very interesting is that dating back to the beginning of the 2018-19 season, the best team in all of college basketball to the under has been Arkansas, because last year, Arkansas had about 70% or so of their games go under, despite the fact that you've got a coaching change. Right now, Arkansas, they played 3 overs so far this year. So this has been a team that you've been wanting to hammer the under with. I do think that they're going to do a good job of being able to slow things down, because with LSU, sometimes get a little bit loose with the ball. But I think that this is just a bad matchup in general for Arkansas, because against a team that shoots prolifically from three-point range, they're able to cut you off. Against a team that likes to go down low like LSU, a little bit of a different story. And Arkansas can sometimes struggle to flow their offense as well. This is actually a spot where I do think that LSU being the favorite is the right call. And I do think that this is going to be a game in which we're going to see a struggle to score. And I think that the Arkansas unders are going to come through once again.
Well, I wanted to make sure that we spent the majority of the segment here talking college basketball with you, but I am going to crowdsource opinions here throughout the week on the show about the NFL playoffs for the divisional round. For those that don't know, you also play side and total in every NFL game. So a very, very high volume style from you. As we look at the divisional round here, what's your favorite play? What's the game that you're kind of on the fence about right now? What are you looking at here for this weekend?
Right now, my favorite play is the under in this Green Bay versus Seattle Seahawks game. So many people are looking at the Seattle Seahawks, and they're saying, this is a team that's not necessarily playing a lot of defense. And I'm someone, I was born and raised in Wisconsin. I know this team quite well. And I know the fact that as I look at the weather right now, out in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, it is currently 9 degrees. And taking a look at the weekend, looks like you're going to get some snow for Saturday into Sunday as well. That makes things very sloppy. Right now, we're seeing a total out there in the high 40s. At last check, it's 47. May have moved a half a point when this thing drops. But with that said, I am all aboard the under in this spot, because with Seattle, right now you're relying upon a guy named Homer, Marshawn Lynch, guys like this to be able to run the ball. And they're having to try to do this out in a place in Lambeau that is going to be very cold, likely going to be windy, perhaps some snow. And with Aaron Rodgers, just does not look like himself as well. And I feel like the Packers have a little bit of an edge with that regard with Aaron Jones. And the Packers all year long have been playing some solid defense. And I feel like the Seattle defense is a little bit underrated. Certainly, you look a little bit better when you go up against Josh McCown rather than Carson Wentz, but they held the Eagles to single digits in that game. I just don't see what team gets a 21 in this spot. So right now, what I'm really loving in this NFL playoffs for a play is Seattle versus Green Bay under.
Is there a game that you're still kind of trying to decide, still sort of weighing your options with?
I'm really dialed in on a lot of these games just because I do feel like in the two AFC games between Tennessee and Baltimore and Houston versus Kansas City, if you're able to grab a 10, do it. If you're right now thinking that you're on the fence with it, just wait to see if something ticks a 10. If not, grab the 9.5 just because these are postseason games. I think that they're going to be very much nip and tuck, and we are seeing Baltimore having a couple questions about Mark Ingram. Probably should be able to go, and probably if he does go, it's going to be closer to 100%, but obviously a status that you want to monitor. The biggest one for me is this Minnesota versus San Francisco game. At under a touchdown, I do think that San Francisco is a good play, but across Las Vegas, as I'm seeing it right now, I am seeing this painted all sevens. I think that this is a game that is going to be your classic one touchdown game with the Minnesota Vikings. It feels like Kirk Cousins starting to step up in these big spots. You got to think that the completion that he had late in the game to Adam Thielen just has his confidence sky high. He's screaming. You like that out there in the locker room. And with the San Francisco 49ers, you've obviously got one of the better pass rushers that we've seen in the past couple of years. You've got guys like Bosa and company coming at you, firing at all cylinders. So I do think that that's an interesting dynamic. But with the Minnesota defense, they've been doing a very good job of just being able to play some pressure man defense when it comes to the secondary. So I think that that's a little bit of an intriguing battle. So right now, the toughest call for me is laying a 7 with San Francisco. If you're able to get a 6.5, take it. But as I'm seeing it right now, it's sitting on 7, and that would be for me a just hold off and see which way the line moves sort of situation.
Well, as I mentioned, Greg Peterson, contributor to VSiN as well as their Point Spread weekly newsletter. But Greg, your claim to fame is your Hoopin' with Hoops podcast. Tell our listeners how they can get it and what it's all about.
You can find this thing on any podcast platform that you subscribe to. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, or TuneIn, you name it. You got it. It's Hoopin' with Hoops, H-O-O-P-I-N, with an apostrophe at the end. It's how you spell Hoopin', by the way. And if that's a little bit too hard for you to remember, I've got the link at the top of my Twitter profile, at @junior_d1. That is a hub for everything. I tweet out the link to that podcast every day. I always alert people to when I am on the Vegas Stats and Information Network. And by the way, a little bit of tease for you. Wes Reynolds is going to be coming up. Guy does a terrific job with the Green Zone. Guy is an amazing golf handicapper. I'm sure that I'm saying information that everyone knows at this point, but very happy to have him aboard the Vegas Stats and Information Network. And for myself, I just always love being able to give out my plays on Twitter as well, @junior_d1. And you mentioned the podcast. I break down every one of my sides and totals every single game. Everything from like your ACC and Big Ten conference games to something like the University of Maryland, Baltimore County tonight. If I've got it posted up on my Twitter feed, I'm going to give you guys a breakdown for it, and I do every single game. So it is a guarantee that it's going to be on the podcast.
Greg Peterson, again, the Hoopin' with Hoops podcast. You can also find him on VSiN, and again, that's @GUnit_81 on Twitter. Greg, always a pleasure to chat with you, man. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Adam, looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right, there you go. There's Greg Peterson again, the Hoopin' with Hoops podcast, @GUnit_81 on Twitter. And, of course, you can hear him on VSiN and see him in that Point Spread weekly newsletter. We got one more guest, one more segment here for this Wednesday edition of Bang the Book Radio. That is with Wes Reynolds, @WesReynolds and the number one on Twitter, contributor to VSiN as well as VSiN's Point Spread weekly newsletter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Adam, doing well. Happy New Year to you, pal.
Happy New Year to you as well. Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks. We haven't talked since before Christmas here on the show with Christmas and New Year's Day falling on Wednesdays here this year. I know you got the chance to head on down to the Gator Bowl. How was that experience for you?
It was a really good experience, except for the final 5 minutes of the game when it looked like Indiana was going to get their first win in a bowl game since 1991 at the Copper Bowl, and that at 22-9 and allow a score, and then weren't ready for the onside kick, which inevitably is going to come in a bowl game because you don't go to a bowl game to necessarily lose. So you're going to take some chances, and Indiana ends up falling a point short. But the bowl game was good. I mean, the people were friendly. The Tennessee fans, especially, every single fan base has its certain percentage of people that you kind of want to hide and like, well, they don't associate with us. I mean, so that's representative of every fan base. But I thought the Tennessee people, by and large, were amazing. They were friendly. They were gracious. They travel well. That's still a really huge, and I know the football program has slipped a lot from their usual standard, but that's a program that's a big fan base, and they travel.
Yeah, they definitely do, and that's one of the fun things about bowl games, especially those ones in warmer weather cities. You know, you do get to see which fan bases travel and which ones don't, and you know that can always be something of a betting angle once we head on into the next round of bowl games here on a little bit under a year. But for now, we're going to talk NFL playoffs here. We've got the divisional round, four games coming up. The four home teams all idle last week because they earned bye weeks based on what they did during the regular season. So let me start with that here real quickly, Wes. Sometimes the bye week is a bad thing. Sometimes the bye week is a good thing. I know it's on a case-by-case basis, but as far as these four teams go, San Francisco, Baltimore, Kansas City, and Green Bay, do you think one team benefited more from a bye than another? Do you think one team would have rather kept playing?
Yeah, and that's kind of the trick of this week, because if you actually look, I believe this is since 2003, divisional round road underdogs, where we're currently in for this weekend, 36-24-1. So that's 60% against the spread, because we know that home field, you're going to pay a little bit of tax with teams with byes in terms of home field. I think in terms of maybe the tougher schedule spot, it's a little bit tougher for Minnesota because they do have to turn around and play that first game on Saturday. So maybe that benefits even the favorite, the 49ers, who haven't been in this position very often because they haven't really been in the playoffs, to kind of get the nerves out and to play that first game early and not have to watch football over the weekend and maybe be the Sunday game or the late game on Sunday. So they can kind of get out there and get after it early and then get the jitters or any nerves that they may have out early. So in terms of, I guess, a benefit, I mean, it's a little difficult to find maybe necessarily somebody that benefited. I think perhaps you could say Tennessee a little bit because they beat the New England Patriots and all the storylines with Vrabel, the former player, going up to play against Bill Belichick or coach against Bill Belichick. So, I mean, to maybe get that out of the way and now be able to just focus on football. So perhaps Tennessee is the team that benefited in that regard.
All right, so as you mentioned, a tough spot here for the Vikings in game 301-302. Travel back from New Orleans off the overtime win. Cross-country trip on a short week to play San Francisco. San Francisco right now 7 market-wide, 44 the total. Pretty much market-wide with that number as well. It certainly looks, at least at first glance to me, that this spot for Minnesota probably is factored into the line to a certain degree.
Yeah, it already is. I mean, you're paying a tax, and this is one of the underdogs that I think that you're going to get split support, whether you want to call it the quote quasi sharp side or whatever, or the Joe side. I think you're going to see both contingents, or a fair amount of both contingents, really support this Minnesota side. I lean with the 49ers here. The trends kind of all favor Minnesota, and this is the first time that the 49ers under this new regime of Shanahan and John Lynch have been in the playoffs. But they really, when you looked at the regular season, I know it had to come down to the last game, and there was some questionable officiating in Seattle on that last drive, not reviewing the potential holding in the end zone or the interference. But if you really look holistically at the season, the 49ers are the deserved number one seed in the NFC. And I think they were the best team in the regular season. And I think it was pretty clear, because you look at the point differential, and I think it was, I don't have the exact number, I can't remember it right offhand, but it was in like the 160s. Like, the second place team in the NFC, I think, was New Orleans in terms of point differential, and they were like 50 points behind the 49ers. So this is a team that won a lot of games and won them convincingly. And I mean, Kirk Cousins, I do think credit to him. He got the bugaboo off and won a big game on the road, so he doesn't have to hear that as much anymore. But I think the 49ers are out to kind of prove, because I think they might think that, a lot of people don't believe in us, or a lot of people don't believe that they're for real. So I would expect a big time effort from them here.
I think this is a challenging handicap. And to me, I think this could very well be the best game of the weekend. I think there's a chance that that's the case. But I also think this one may be the most difficult handicap of them all, because San Francisco early in the year, and maybe some of this had to do with the schedule they played, their defense was dominant, and they were winning a lot of lower scoring games. Second half of the year, there were some cracks in the armor for that defense, but the offense got better and they won some higher scoring games. So it was really a tale of two seasons for San Francisco. But as the point I belabored many times over on this show, San Francisco had their bye in week four. So that defense that got relied on so heavily early on in the year just kind of got a little bit tired and worn down in the second half of the season. Now they're off of that bye. On the flip side, with Minnesota, when was this offense fully healthy over the course of the year? And we saw the impact of Adam Thielen in last week's game, where Stephon Diggs did nothing, Dalvin Cook was kind of bottled up a little bit, and Adam Thielen did everything. So you've got a Minnesota team at full strength now for one of the few times here throughout the season. So I think this handicap is very, very challenging.
It is, and I think you make a very good point, because the 49ers did battle a little bit of injuries on defense late in the year, but they've kind of been playing through injuries all year. A lot of the injuries, though, have been more on the offense, especially at receiver, at the offensive line. Juszczyk was out, the fullback that they like to use for several weeks. And also, when I look at this game of the four games, I mean, everything is teasable. It's just, teasable through key numbers or not. This is really the only game, because we had a lot of games last weekend that were kind of the teaser possibilities. And if you look at the other games, they're double digits. So you can't do the 5.5, 6-point teaser to get favorites down through the 3 and the 7. This is really about the only one. So that I think does the teasers in terms of the logical key numbers. So this will be interesting to see how this is monitored. I think this is a two-way action game. I don't think that this is going to go any north of 7, and it could maybe even close under 7. It is a difficult handicap. I'm going, I think, just on more, a little bit more on gut here with the 49ers, because I do think that they get the good scheduling spot and the fact that they're out to prove something. I mean, because they've never proven anything, bettors, I think, are going to bet what they know and what they can quantify. And what they can quantify is this team hasn't won a playoff game. So it's not like they're necessarily going to rush to the window as much to bet them as they would the more proven commodities, the Patriots or the Chiefs or the Saints or teams like that.
Speaking of two-way action, it seems like we got quite a bit of it here in game 303, 304, Tennessee and Baltimore. Baltimore got as low as 8, 8.5 out there in the market, but now we're back up to 9.5 and 10, pretty much market-wide. Totals come down a little bit, 48 to as low as 46.5. But this is one where we've seen two-way action, influential two-way action. Early move to drive the number down, a little bit of a later move Tuesday to drive the number back up. This is a tough one too. And I mean, I don't mean to, sort of sidestep all these games. I do have some stronger opinions for the Sunday games, but two-way action so far on this one, where do you think this one ultimately lands?
Yeah, I think it probably stays the same. I think if it gets to 10 again, you see more Tennessee money come in. I think it's probably going to be in that 8.5, 9 range come Sunday, and look for the Titans. Why not? You look at the difference with Ryan Tannehill. They're 7-3-1 against the spread. They've averaged about 29.5 points a game. So the point differential has been higher. If you look at the starts Mariota made, they were only averaging 16.3 a game. So you've got some evidence here and some logical support of the Titans side, because they clearly, even though he only passed for however many yards, like 70-some yards in New England last week, he's been winning and he's been leading them, and they believe in him, I think. So that's one of the reasons I think you can see support for Tennessee. And also, I guess, if there is a weakness, and it's tough to find a weakness with a 14-2 team in the National Football League, but if there is a weakness in that Ravens defense, it's actually more of the rushing defense. I think they rank like 15th or 16th in the league for per Football Outsiders in terms of rushing defense. So that's right in the middle of the pack. So that's not a bad rush defense, but it's not an elite rush defense either. And you look at what Henry did last week. He had 182 yards in Foxborough last week against the Patriots. 138 of them were after contact. And this is a guy that's really, really hard to bring down. And you know that what Tennessee is going to do. And they did what they had to do. They didn't win pretty, but they executed on third down. They played good defense in the red zone, keeping New England out of the end zone. So that's what I think the Titans are going to have to do. The offensive strength of schedule, when I saw for the Ravens, I was looking at some of these Pro Football Focus and Football Outsiders numbers, and I don't get too knee deep in the weeds with these numbers necessarily, but the Ravens offensive strength of schedule of opponents they faced this year ranked 30th in the league. So this is a good defense, but they have not really done it against the upper echelon of competition. So Tennessee would be the side. That would be the only side I'm probably looking to bet here. I just think that that number could be a little bit inflated. And there's the consensus belief that I think that Baltimore, that people think Baltimore is the best team in the AFC, and they very well might be. But the team that I think has really been coming over the last several weeks is Kansas City.
Well, and what's really interesting here about this one, too, is that, you know, we talk about the bye, and if it's a bad thing, Lamar Jackson hasn't played in 3 weeks.
Right.
You know, and Mark Ingram's on the shelf, not seen at practice yesterday. We'll see if he winds up practicing late in the week. You would think Baltimore's game plan here would be, you know, they're going to throw it with Lamar when they need to, but they want to keep that Tennessee offense off the field too. For one of the reasons you just mentioned, they haven't been tested by many offenses that, you know, played as well as Tennessee's did down the stretch. So that's part of the equation here. You've got to see what Baltimore looks like coming off the shelf with a lot of rust potential. Tennessee's got to play well in the first quarter. If they don't play well in the first quarter, they cannot win this game. I'd be worried about their ability to cover the number. If they play well in the first quarter, this thing's probably a dogfight throughout. The problem is, I don't know if that's going to happen. So I don't think this is a good full game betting matchup here in the playoffs. I guess this is a great live betting game.
Yeah, I do too. And perhaps if you're banking on Tennessee getting that good start early on, then you'd bet them maybe in the first quarter or perhaps in the first half, just kind of looking through those numbers. Tennessee first quarter, I think, is like 3.5 or 3 with juice, and first half should be around 6. And in fact, that's pretty much right where they are. You know, maybe that's what you bank on here, or that's the gamble you have to make if you like the Tennessee side, because I think that's such a salient and good point that this is a team that has to get off to a good start, because if they don't, it can get away from them. If you recall the Houston game in Baltimore earlier in the season, Houston didn't get off to a good start, and that got very ugly as the game went on.
All right, so we move over to Sunday here. We talk about game 305, 306, Houston and Kansas City. Kansas City up from 8 to 9.5, a few tens out there. Total also going up on this game, 49-51. And it sounds like, you know, you said that you feel like the Chiefs are the team that's been coming here in the AFC over the last several weeks. Are you going to lay that big number this weekend?
You know, I usually don't like to be honest with you. I don't like to lay these big, huge favorites in the NFL, especially in the playoffs. But this is one I would lean towards doing. I have not done it yet because I don't think there's that much of a difference. It's moved up from 8. I don't think you know, going to 9 or 9.5, you're not getting the best of the number, but you're not really getting killed on not getting a key number in that regard here. Look, Kansas City's probably as healthy as they've been all season, really on both sides of the ball. And you're getting a team that I think you get a coach too, and Andy Reid, that is pretty darn good off a bye week. I think with more than a week off, he's only second behind Bill Belichick in terms of with the extra week to prepare and off a bye week. So that's pretty high cotton and high praise to be in terms of that category or characteristic. But yeah, Kansas City, I just believe that they are starting to get a little healthy. The offensive numbers aren't what they were. So maybe people aren't as enamored with Kansas City because they're not doing what they did in the first 4 weeks of the season, where they're scoring 40 points all the time and they're getting in the 400, 500 yard rate, a range of total offense for a game. But the defense has been better. If you look at the last 6 weeks, the last six games, rather, they've only allowed 69 points. So that's 11.5 points a game that they've allowed. The defense has really been good. It's been healthier. Steve Spagnuolo has done a really good job with that defense. And he's really a proven defensive coordinator in this league. We remember what he did with the Giants all those years in the Super Bowl runs. But, yeah, and with Houston, you got a team. Look, they were DOA last week because I was on them. And they were down 16-0 at one point. I mean, this game was all but over. They couldn't do anything, and then they finally get the touchdown late in the third quarter and get the two-point conversion and end up kind of pulling it out and taking advantage of some bad Buffalo decision-making and some mistakes down the stretch, not using timeouts at a certain point. The big sack Josh Allen took that really took them out of field goal, out of potential field goal range. And And I haven't really been enamored with Houston all year. Deshaun Watson is terrific, but I don't think that this is the hugely, overwhelmingly talented team that people kind of think. I think they have a few really good players at the top, and then there's a big drop-off in the roster. And I guess other teams can kind of fall into that category too, but I'd be more prone to laying it with Kansas City here. And maybe also Kansas City, I don't know if they might be disappointed that they didn't get New England in the rematch, but they did beat them earlier in the season. So it's like, okay, well, we've got the Patriots out of this. So this has opened up a little bit more for us now in terms of our chances to get to a Super Bowl. So I would, anything under 10, I would be more prone to laying Kansas City than taking Houston.
Yeah, I'm on Kansas City here myself. The 9.5 is fine with me. Even at 10, obviously, you know, you don't have to take 10 because 9.5 is out there in the market. But if for some reason you're worried about something, I think Kansas City wins this game comfortably. I really, truly do. You know, you've got a Houston team that still tons of problems on the offensive line. And last week, I thought Sean McDermott was a coaching advantage over Bill O'Brien. And in the first half, he was. And in the second half, he wasn't. Andy Reid's not going to do that. And a lot of people used to, you know, piss on the parade of Andy Reid because, oh, he got so conservative late in games and, you know, he kind of played not to lose and this and that. Well, if you recall, 3 or 4 years ago, there was kind of a paradigm shift for Andy Reid where he stopped doing that and stopped going into a shell. I don't think he does it this week. And I think he has the opportunity to go out there and really put this game away in the second half. The under trend, and I'm not a trends guy. I never have been. I never will be. But I talk about it with Andy Reid, 23-4-1 to the under after a bye. That one matters to me because you're off a bye here. You're in the playoffs. You had time to prep for Houston. And if this game is going to be high scoring, as the total implies, now up to 51, it means that Houston has to score. If Houston's not going to score, you know who's going to? Kansas City, which is why they should cover this 9.5.
Yeah, I totally agree. And look, it's even maybe depressed it a little bit, the fact that Kansas City has not really put up the huge offensive numbers. But I think that perhaps that they're capable. But I think that does take a little bit of a pressure off the offense and the fact that your defense can now get stops. I think a lot of that Kansas City offense early in the season was predicated on the fact that you had a lot of new faces on defense, and they couldn't really trust them to get teams off the field unless the other team gave the ball away to them. They weren't necessarily getting a ton of three and out stops or conventional stops where they're just not giving the opposing offense much. But I think now at least there's a little bit more of a confidence with the defense that, hey, they can get these guys off the field. And what you mentioned about Houston's offensive line, totally true. I think, wow, I forget the tally. I think the Bills had at least 7 sacks last week of Deshaun Watson. So Kansas City, I got to think, can get their fair share here.
Yeah, I believe it was 7 sacks, 15 quarterback hits, and then Watson ran, what, 16 times?
Mm-hmm.
So he wound up getting hit, you know, what, 20, 25 times last week? I mean, that's not great when Patrick Mahomes is, you know, feet up on the couch, just kind of watching the game.
Man, right.
That's not a very good thing for Houston. Not to say that, you know, it's the playoffs. Everyone's going to deal with whatever they're dealing with. But at the same time, I mean, Watson took some punishment last week. Mahomes didn't. Nobody for the Chiefs did. So maybe that's an angle that definitely helps Kansas City here this weekend. Finally, one more game in the NFL playoffs here, 307-308. Seattle and Green Bay. Green Bay -4, just about market wide in the offshore marketplace. There is a rogue 3.5 out there. Total up from 46 to as high as 47.5. Interestingly enough, the 47.5 is at Pinnacle, which, you know, probably the best barometer we have of sharp action out there in the offshore marketplace. But Wes, I got to say, man, I want to bet against both of these teams, and obviously I can't because they're playing each other.
Yeah, you're reading my mind here. This is kind of, and it may sound absurd to say, considering these two teams have won 25 combined games. They're not bad teams, but it does kind of look like a battle of the paper tigers, doesn't it? I think when you look at Seattle, look, they were, what, +7 going into the playoffs in terms of point differential. We know that they've won so many close games this year, and they caught their fair share of breaks. And credit to them and fair play to them for taking advantage of them. But they catch another break in the playoffs. Carson Wentz goes out very early in the game. So, I've never really been a huge Carson Wentz guy, but McCown is going to be a downgrade from him, a guy that really can't do a lot of scrambling because there were openings for him to scramble, but he's a 40-some-year-old pocket passing quarterback. He's not going to be able to make those plays with his legs that maybe Wentz, if he's willing to do that, could be able to do. So Seattle catches another break last week in terms of going against a backup quarterback, and they get a win on the road, and Philadelphia basically just couldn't get him off the field in third down. I mean, it was basically what Seattle does. Russell Wilson wins the game for him. Now, I guess the one thing you can look for Seattle is that it's not just Wilson to lock it anymore. They've got DK Metcalf they can trust to make plays down the field. But I've not been really high on Seattle all year. And Green Bay was my pick at the beginning of the season to represent the NFC in the Super Bowl. And I do have a Super Bowl future on them. But they're not that great when you look at them. I mean, 13-3. Aaron Rodgers is basically his career low in terms of yards per pass attempt. I think he's averaging 7.0. So that's like right in the middle of the pack. We don't usually see Aaron Rodgers in the middle of the pack in any passing statistic. But he hasn't been the vintage Aaron Rodgers. He's been good. He's been effective. But he hasn't been elite. And I think that's what we look at Aaron Rodgers, is that he's an elite quarterback. One of the things that was curious to me is the move on the over. And I don't know if that's going to be done to kind of set this up over the weekend, because this is a cold weather game. So usually cold weather games kind of get bet to the under more often than not. But we are seeing the move on the over a little bit. So if you like the under, I think obviously you wait as long as you can. But this struck me as kind of a game in the low 20s between both of these teams. And I don't really know which side to go on. The ultimate lean, if you say, Wes, you got to give us a pick here, I would say Green Bay. But I don't know if I'm prone to bet that side.
Well, and something else that's interesting about the totals move here, too, and, you know, there are a lot of people out there in the NFL community I greatly respect in terms of looking at player props, in terms of looking at game flow, in terms of looking at success rates. A lot of people like Aaron Jones to have a nice game for Green Bay this week. Well, if Green Bay is running the football, then why is this thing going to go over the total? So that's kind of part of the equation here, too, where it does sort of feel like a little bit of a setup here. You want to try and pick this thing off at the pinnacle. Maybe it's 47 and a half. Maybe it's 47 in a lot of places. But I agree with you. I think if I had to play this one, I would be taking a look at the under. I don't want to dive too deep into the weeds here with this, but real quickly, you mentioned you have a Green Bay Super Bowl future. Are you looking to hedge that this week, or do they need to win another game? Because otherwise, they're taking a lot of the equity away from that ticket, hedging so early on.
Yeah, that's kind of the debate here, because if you got Green Bay and the 49ers, especially I would in the NFC Championship game, I would certainly be looking to hedge. I know there's revenge there because they got waxed on a Sunday night, but I don't think that they can beat that team. And nothing convinced me from that game that was kind of a fluke, or they were kind of, you know, they're kind of close. They just had a couple bad breaks go their way. They got their butts kicked in that Sunday night game out in San Francisco at Levi's Stadium. So I'm not convinced that it would go that much differently the second time around. So that's kind of the debate I'm making. For sure, I would probably start the hedging next week if they get San Francisco.
And, of course, they did beat Minnesota twice, but, you know, the playoffs are a different animal. And I don't care about
close games.
Right. And I don't care about beating a team three times in a season. That's just some kind of narrative bullshit. But, you know, that's the thing here is, you know, for Green Bay, they're a clear-cut dog to San Francisco. That line against Minnesota is interesting because Minnesota would take sharp money in that game, I would think. And maybe it opens, absolutely. Maybe it opens 2.5-ish. Green Bay minus 2.5 at home, minus 2, something like that. You got to, you know, give respect to Lambeau Field at home field. But at the same time, in Minnesota right now, probably the better team. So that's the tough thing here about betting any futures market, but especially the NFL. You get a team that gets a bye in a top 2 seed and you still don't feel super confident in that position that you've got.
Yeah. We were talking about that on our show earlier this week in terms of Super Bowl futures. And I just don't think at this point that there's a lot of value. I mean, you'd probably be much more prone to do kind of that money line rollover deal.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Something we will talk about a ton when we get to college basketball conference tournaments and the NCAA tournament here in, not the too distant future, but 8 or 9 weeks away from conference tournaments here starting up. But let's go to Hawaii, because all of us should do that here in the month of January for the Sony Open over in Hawaii. We didn't get a chance to talk Tournament of Champions with you last week. I don't know if you had any piece of the winner there in that one, but Justin Thomas coming off that win, a 5-1 favorite here in Honolulu for this one. Webb Simpson, 11, Patrick Reed, 12, Morikawa, 15, Matsuyama in the 16 range, then on down from there. Anybody you're looking to take a shot with here this week at the Sony?
Yeah, unfortunately, I had the runner-up last week, that being Patrick Reed, who lost on the third playoff hole. And really, he probably lost it even before that. The putting performance was terrific, 45-1 putts on 72 holes, but just didn't strike the ball well enough, didn't hit enough greens, really. So that's kind of what probably put him in the position where he had to be in a playoff in the first place. But Thomas is the rightful favorite here. He's obviously short, too short to take it. 5-1, but he has every record at this tournament that he set here 2 years ago. He's got the 18-hole record, the 36-hole record, the 54-hole record, and the 72-hole record. He finished 27 under 253 2 years ago. But if I was looking at maybe one of the shorter guys, the one shorter guy I kind of like a little bit is Morikawa, and I got him at 18-1. Morikawa's got a lot of family in Maui and Oahu, so he probably got through that family distraction last week and had a real solid top 10 finish last week. So maybe puts it behind him and focuses on the golf this week. A couple other guys, Joaquin Neiman, who's anywhere around 30-1. He finished top 7 last week. He got the worst of the conditions on Sunday and still shot a solid round when the wind was blowing a lot more. He's a good ball striker, and he's also kind of a course correlation design. He won his first PGA Tour event on a design by Seth Rayner, who designed the old white TPC, which is the course they play for the Greenbrier. He's also designed this course at Wailea. So, I mean, there's a little angle. You don't read too much into that, but there's a little angle, I guess, in his favor. And then I went down the board with a few guys, just guys that are, I think, are really good coastal courses that are shorter courses, because this is only a par 70, about 7,000 yards. It's very scoreable. But a guy like Kevin Kisner kind of stood out to me at around anywhere from 40 to 50 to 1, because he's really good on these type of courses. And then one bomb that I took, because one of the things I think we're going to get this week, looking at the forecast, Adam, is that we're going to get some trade winds around 25 miles an hour. So a shorter course, a windy course, guy that's won on coastal courses before, older player, but 150 to 1, I did take a shot with Graham McDowell in this event, because this is a guy, look, he's won at Pebble Beach, he's won at Harbortown, he's won at Mayakoba, he won, last year at the Dominican Republic. So this is a guy that likes shorter coastal golf courses. And then some of the middle price guys, Sebastian Munoz, I think could be worth a look at 60 to 1. And then one angle that's been pretty good here, and actually each of the last 6 years, I think 7 of the last 8, 9 of the last 12, a player that plays the week before at the Century Tournament of Champions in Kapalua goes on to win this event, usually. And it's happened each of the last 6 years. So and that kind of makes sense with that rest versus rust theory, because there's a lot of guys that hadn't played in a couple months, especially if they didn't play in the President's Cup or they didn't really play in any other events internationally. So this is the first event of the year for a lot of guys. So it really makes a lot of sense. I think there were 23 players all in all when I did my count of guys that played in that 34-man field last week that are going to go ahead and tee it up this week.
Wes Reynolds, whose work you can hear on VSiN and also see in that Point Spread weekly newsletter, of course, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Wes, when can people hear you on VSiN?
Okay, I will be on tomorrow and Friday from 8 to 10 Pacific. I split the Thursday and Friday with Amal Shah and Brady Cannon. So you can hear me on those days. And then Saturday, 2 to 6 Pacific. So we'll be right in the middle, kind of in between the wild card games both days, 2 to 6 Pacific Saturday, 3 to 7 Pacific Sunday. And then we're also doing our bet cast, 5 hours long. We're going to be doing that Monday night, more than the usual spot on the Green Zone with myself and Brady Cannon. We'll have a cavalcade of thousands on that bet cast for the college football playoff national championship game Monday night.
Now, of course, that massive prop catalog for the national championship game, something we hope to talk about a little bit later on in the week here on Bang the Book Radio, as long as we have some of those props. Otherwise, we'll talk about them next Monday with Kyle Hunter. But in any event, Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Again, you can hear him on VSiN and see him in that Point Spread weekly newsletter. Wes, always a treat, man. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Adam. Always a pleasure, man.
There you go. There's Wes Reynolds again, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Make sure you listen to him over on VSiN. Coming up on our Thursday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we'll chat with professional handicapper Brad Powers from bradpowerssports.com. We'll talk national championship. We'll get an idea of what we can with the prop market and also talk here about the divisional round in the NFL playoffs. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.